The Pat Kenny Show
with Mater Private Network
on News Talk.
And this is The Pat Kenny Show with Anton in for Pat. Between 1959 and 1999, Ireland went from a period of falling significantly behind the living standards of the rest of Europe to accelerating to almost parity, and then for a lot of them to be in prime position ahead of them. At the centre of this transformation was the Irish Department of Finance. And in his new book, The Irish Department of Finance, 1959 to 99, Dr. Kieran Casey shows us how contributing factors led to a boom in the 90s that was exceptional by world standards. And Kieran, of course, is an economic historian and lecturer in economics and UL, and therefore has a much fancier term than the one that I would use. But am I right in saying, Kieran, that effectively, from the 50s through the 60s, Ireland was an economic basket case?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, both in the 50s and the 80s, people were kind of questioning, is this whole independence thing working out? Living standards have fallen that far behind. And as you say, come the 1990s, no one was predicting the economy to take off in the way that it did. There was a meeting, kind of a bunch of the head people in finance met out in Barrettstown, and they were trying to work out, well, what are we going to do about unemployment running into the next decade? And one suggestion was we should teach kids in school German, because that's the country they're going to emigrate to and they'll use the language. And through the 1990s, employment grows by 49%.
This is an interesting thing with the book, because we have a tendency, and you say so in the book, to use the UK as our benchmark. Yeah. And therefore, there is a sort of a legacy sense that the 50s was just generally bleak. It wasn't across the rest of Europe.
No, not at all. No, the 50s, so that whole period was a golden age for the rest of Europe. And the 1960s, so Ireland did, people who lived through the 60s will consider it to have been a bit of an economic golden age. It was compared to the 50s, it wasn't compared to the rest of Europe. So in that decade, we were passed out by other peripheral countries like Greece, Portugal, Spain. By 1970, Ireland's at about 54%, according to officials in the department, at about 54% of the living standards of the rest of Western Europe. We've fallen way behind. That changes when we join the EEC, which is precursor to the European Union, at which point Ireland starts to catch up. But then we go through this horrible, protracted, horrible crisis in the 1980s. And by 1990, we're still only about 2/3 of the living standards of the rest of Western Europe.
Explain the policy and ideological changes that led to the membership of the European Union, because it was a significant shift from insular protectionism to a much more open economy, driven largely by T.K. Whittaker.
Yeah, it's gas. So the department, to its infinite credit, was very good about letting me kind of pop the Whittaker myth a lot. So there's a big scrap in the late 1950s, early 1960s, between the Department of Industry and Commerce, with their head JCB McCarthy, who'd been in finance in his youth, and Whittaker, who's the youngest secretary of any department, and he's in finance. And
he was only 39 when
he was 39, was your point. Yeah, the two first guys were, I think, 35 and 36, which is just gruesome. Whittaker's argument is the rest of Europe is joining the EEC or other trade associations. If we don't join now, we'll get left behind. And he says, well, look, if we join industry, it'll adapt, it'll change, it'll catch up. McCarthy is much closer to the action, and he knows a lot of these companies are absolutely rubbish. If you think the big Irish industries at the time were clothing manufacture, footwear, car assembly, they all go to the wall. Whittaker's plan is we'll join and these will catch up, and they don't. So there's huge employment losses in those sectors. McCarthy is saying you can't just, on the basis that you think this will work out, you can't just join Europe and kind of, you know, let those go to the wall and not have a plan. So Brendan Keenan, the journalist, has said, you know, they were both right, which I think is very generous. I think they're also both wrong, which is just as important. And in a way, foreign direct investment, the multinational companies come along and save our bacon.
By virtue of the fact that we had European Union membership and therefore access to that giant market.
Yeah, the two biggest things. So the recipe that works for Ireland, which nobody fully anticipated in advance, certainly not Whittaker, is low corporate tax rates and membership of a single market. Because the idea is that all of the US multinationals want to come here and sell into that market. They're looking for a foothold so that they can jump, you know, a common tariff wall into Europe. And they're looking for the country with low corporate tax rates.
But you're saying that there wasn't that degree of prescience at the time, that wasn't, the effect was not as known or as expected?
Not anticipated within finance, not at all. Within industry and commerce, people who've studied that more have suggested to me they had a bit of an inkling. They thought it would be good for them, but they didn't see it as being this kind of overall national economic strategy. So it's two really good policies. They worked very well together. What's gas is in the 1950s, when low corporate tax rates were first brought in, finance had opposed it. And the IDA had pushed it, and industry and commerce. Then in the 1960s, finance wanted to join the European Economic Community than the EU, and Industry and Commerce oppose it. So you got each department got one thing it wanted and lost another battle, and actually it's a two-in combination that worked really, really well.
It's also interesting when you look at that joining of the EEC, it is easy to forget how closely coupled we were to the UK and how much our membership depended on their membership.
Yeah, absolutely. No, Whitaker knew that. I mean, we couldn't join. The nightmare scenario was Britain joining without us, because we had preferential access, particularly for agriculture, into the UK market. And the absolute fear was that if we got shut out and Britain got in, that we'd lose that preferential access, all the rest of the EEC would get preferential access into Britain, and we'd be shut out of our primary market. So, you know, in a parallel universe, we're living in a very different country.
There's also some very interesting parallels from the past. It's interesting how much history repeats itself. One of the things that I think came in the early 70s, you talk about the switch from the estate taxes to the wealth taxes, and how completely politically impossible it was to have a wealth tax, which of course we're seeing reflected only this week in the inheritance tax discussions.
Yeah, it got killed. So the wealth tax was proposed, and it just politically, I mean, there was just an outcry about it. It got watered down so much that by the time it was implemented, I think the rate was only about 1%. You know, there were exceptions. It just got eroded into nothingness. It's one of those things that, you know, it might have been a good plan, but the political system just butchered it.
The other thing where there is a startling parallel is in rates of inflation and interest rates. No matter how bad 2022 feels, it ain't the 70s.
No, absolutely not. Yeah, so the 70s, again, the parallels are amazing. So the 70s, you've two oil crises, one in 73 and one in 79. Ireland, it's hard to kind of convey how much more reliant, nearly totally reliant Western economies were on oil at that point. If you think, like, much more kind of much bigger car engines, very badly insulated houses and so on. In 73, Israel gets invaded by Egypt and Syria and beats them back, and OPEC kind of reduced supply and jack up prices. Over that decade, oil prices went up tenfold. For a country like Ireland, it goes from spending about 2.5% of its national income a year in 73 on oil imports to three times that the following year. So people are just poorer. And there's a refusal to accept that. So people who are in work do very, very well. Average real wages after inflation go up by 4.8% a year through the decade. That's a 60% compounded increase over the course of the decade. For people who are unemployed, they just get shut out. They don't get the benefits of that at all.
But the numbers are horrifying. You have a graph that outlines inflation across that period, both for the European Union, for the UK and for Ireland. And UK inflation peaked at 23% and Ireland was just shy of 21%.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, economists and statisticians kind of got, you know, we were so reliant on the UK at that point. We were so closely tied to them that actually there was very little we could do. We were just importing that inflation. It was an enormous inflation rate. And I think the real fear, we're nowhere near the wage price spirals of the 1970s now. Real wages are actually falling, so that's not the thing necessarily to worry about. I think the minimum wage increase is actually definitely the way to go. But the real fear is if that sticks around for the long term, and what the ECB is worrying about, that those inflationary expectations become embedded, that people start demanding, well, look, you know, I think inflation is going to be, you know, whatever in perpetuity, and I want to be compensated for that. And that's a situation we really don't want to get back into.
Although one assumes if they've hiked it by 75 basis points in one move, they're very much not going to let that happen.
No, I mean, the ECB, I mean, their whole raison d'etre is keeping inflation down. I mean, they will. I'd be very surprised if they let that happen.
Talk to me about the culture of the department, because one of the things that's interesting is when you read those early phases of it, the sort of cozy sounds overly pejorative, but the assumed role of the senior white man at the top of the department, who would then go and become a senior white man at the top of the central bank, and the symbiosis there, it really does feel like a radically different era.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah. So, I mean, the culture, you know, a lot of it, the department was very bad at getting its own message out. So, I mean, there was when Whitaker became Secretary of the Department, his former boss, J.J. McGilligott, wrote to him and said, and I think it's a message we all probably should take on, is every single component of the budget, every single additional expenditure can be very worthwhile, but if there's too much of it, then it's very problematic. What you say about the central bank link, the problem there was that the governor of the central bank was pretty much always appointed from the Department of Finance, and often they'd no relevant experience for the central bank. It's very it's a radically different thing. Monetary policy and regulation are very different things. So that kind of bit us then in the 2000s. And since then, I mean, yeah, it's been, you know, they went and got Patrick Conan to do it, who's a financial expert. I mean, he's exactly who you would have wanted there. And since then, it's been an awful lot better.
You talk a little bit about the criticism that the department has had over the years. And there's one line that I liked very much. You said, perhaps the most prevalent criticism of the Department of Finance has been its perceived negativity. This is common internationally. Nigel Lawson suggested that if the British Treasury had an institutional motto, it would be no.
Yeah, absolutely. There's an amazing quote from Lawson, and I think it sums up what... So people in other departments and people across society, I think, see the department as being this very powerful organisation in this period, and now it's the Department for Public Expenditure and Reform as well. The problem is it can get very, very isolated at the cabinet table. So the minister can come in and say, look, we need to keep, you know, the deficit to whatever it is this year, and goes in and his cabinet colleagues... essentially don't play ball. So Lawson also used the line, so he said public expenditure control, if it's done properly, can be really isolating, making it the loneliest place in government. And I think an awful lot of finance ministers have found that, unfortunately.
It'll be interesting to see if Pascal Donoghue takes the escape route that is maybe offered to him. From doing the research for the book, because it's a very comprehensive study of the department across the period, was there anything that surprised you?
Yeah, loads. I, as an economic historian, I kind of went in, I thought this whole economic transformation bit, it was absolutely historic. I think it's one of the biggest things that's ever happened in Ireland. I thought that would be the most interesting bit. But, I mean, what comes through, because finance, so in the, for most of the 20th century, the Department of the Taoiseach was tiny. Finance kind of manages all of that stuff. If you think of now we have the Department of the Taoiseach, deeper expenditure and reform and finance, for most of the 20th century, finance was kind of doing all of that. So it's got a hand in everything. There's stuff just across it that you'd never expect in the book. So the two things that come out most are the moves towards gender equality nationally and protecting Irish heritage. So there's a lot of that in the book, which I really hadn't expected.
The book is The Irish Department of Finance, 1959 to 1999, and the author is Ciarán Casey. Ciarán, thank you very much.
Thanks so much.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Matter Private Network.
Weekdays at 9 a.m. on News Talk.